Well, a recent article in Breitbart News, Breitbart.com, had this headline. It said, climate change skeptics write an open letter urging Pope Francis to rethink global warming. The article was dated April 27th, and it refers to an event that has already taken place, but I still wanted to talk about that open letter. Let me just read a little bit of the article here. It says this, as the Vatican gears up for a high-level workshop on climate change this Tuesday, a group of 90 prominent scientists, religious leaders, and academics have written an open letter to Pope Francis, urging him to entertain the scientific and moral arguments against current climate change theories. The writers profess their appreciation for the Pope's efforts on behalf of the environment and his commitment to Judeo-Christian principle of responsible stewardship for creation, but suggest that the people closest to him may not be providing him with all the facts regarding climate change. The authors contend that contrasting worldviews have led to sloppy reporting of the facts driven by an ideological agenda. Quote, rather than the careful reporting of the best evidence, unquote, they write, quote, we get highly speculative and theory-laden conclusions presented as the assured results of science. In the process, science itself is diminished, and many well-meaning moral and religious leaders risk offering solutions based on misleading science. Well, that's a direct quote in the letter to the Pope and so forth. I thought it would be great to find out more about what's in this letter specifically. And so who better to do that for us than Dr. E. Calvin Beisner. He is the national spokesperson for the Cornwall Alliance for Stewardship of Creation. Their website is www.cornwallalliance.org. That's www.cornwallalliance.org. And you can go out to that website and read the entire open letter. There's the title of it out there, an open letter to Pope Francis on climate change. And you can read the entire letter for yourself out there. Dr. Beisner, welcome back to the Knowing the Truth radio program.
Thanks very much. It's always a pleasure to be on the program with you.
Well, Dr. Beisner, I read a little bit of the intro of what took place, and now we're a couple days removed from that meeting. Just your general thoughts on the open letter, the effectiveness of it, the type of response that you received in putting this open letter together and writing it and so forth and getting a number of folks to sign on to it. Your thoughts in general about the open letter.
Yeah, well, first off, your listeners can read the whole letter itself on our website. Probably the easiest way for them to find it would just be to go to climateletter2popefrancis.org. climateletter2popefrancis.org. And I think it's an exceptional letter in that what it does is it informs Pope Francis and his advisors of the fundamental scientific and economic facts necessary to guide the world to sane and really helpful policies regarding climate change. What we saw in the lead-up to the conference that the Vatican, together with the United Nations, hosted on Tuesday, the 28th of April, was that they were getting only one side in the discussion about climate change, and they were not getting input from those who I think have a much better empirical case. The alarmists on climate change really depend pretty much exclusively on computerized models of how Earth's climate works, and as we point out in our open letter to Pope Francis, those models, on average, simulate twice as much warming as has actually been observed in the relevant period. None of them simulated the fact that there has been no global warming observed for the last 18 years and 4 months. And, in fact, none of the models, even at the lower end of the spectrum, simulate as little warming as has actually occurred over the period in question. which all indicates that the models are very, very badly biased to produce more apparent warming than actually happens in the real world. Mm. And one of the fundamental principles of science is that you have to test any theory by real-world observation, whether it's in the laboratory or out in the open. And if your real-world observation disagrees with the predictions based upon your model, your theory, well, your model or your theory is wrong, period. So as we pointed out in the open letter, this means that the models offer no rational basis for fears of dangerous man-made warming, and therefore no rational basis for any policy about it at all. And the reason why this is so important is simply that the policies being offered to try to reduce man-made warming in the future all would require a massive change from our dependence on fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas, as our primary energy sources, plus nuclear, to what are typically referred to as renewable energy sources, but basically wind and solar. And the problem with that is that not only are wind and solar not, in the long run, particularly better for the environment, because you have to use much more land to generate the same amount of electricity from them than you do from coal or natural gas, but also the cost of generating energy from those is much higher, on average 2 to 8 times as high as the cost of generating it from coal or natural gas or for transportation energy from oil. Mm-hmm. The result of that is trapping societies in long-term poverty because, frankly, no society has ever climbed out of poverty without massive use of fossil fuels for energy. Energy goes into everything that we do, everything that we make. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if you raise the cost of energy, you raise the cost of everything else, and that hurts the poor more than anyone else.
Mm. You write in, I think it's the second paragraph in the letter to the Pope, much of the debate over the environmental stewardship is rooted in a clash of worldviews with conflicting doctrines of God, creation, humanity, sin, and salvation. Unfortunately, that clash often works its way into the very conclusions of an environmental science. So there's a clash of worldviews is really what we see taking place, not so much a clash of real science, right?
Yes, that's correct. And this really goes down to the very basics of how we understand reality. I mean, the alternative worldviews in the environmental movement have their own notions of God, creation, humanity, sin, and salvation. They also have their own notions of epistemology, that is, the theory of knowledge itself. As we point out in the letter, the scientific method of very careful, systematic putting together of theories and then testing those theories by careful observation in the real world and then rejecting them if they don't match that observation. Scientific method arose only once in history and then only one place, and that was medieval Europe. And it was because that civilization was dominated by the biblical worldview that tells us that a rational God designed an ordered universe to be understood by rational people made in his image, and not only to be understood by them, but also to be controlled by them, exercising the dominion over the creation that God gave us in Genesis 1:28 when he told us to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over it. This scientific worldview, this application of the biblical worldview in science, is crucial to the successful functioning of science. Unfortunately, the worldviews that dominate much of the environmentalist movement, whether they are atheistic on the one hand or pantheistic, panentheistic, animistic on the other hand, tend toward irrationalism, and they really tend toward undermining the understanding that the world around us is meant to be understood by us through careful observation. The result that we see in the climate controversy is that in many instances, scientists working on one side anyway in this controversy tend to prefer their model results to real-world observations. And in fact, many of them are taken in by what one major sociologist of science has called seductive simulations. That is, they can no longer keep in their minds the distinction between their computer models of the climate and the real climate itself. And so when they are talking about how a model simulates the way, say, the ocean responds to one stimulus or another, they'll actually call the model the ocean, forgetting that it's not the ocean, it's just a model. And when we observe in the real world, we find that things actually behave very differently from how they expected. And unfortunately, many of these scientists have simply lost the capacity to distance themselves from their models and say, hey, I need to check and correct my model or possibly even abandon it completely when it disagrees with the real-world observations.
One of those observations that I think certainly gets underplayed in the national media is that the dire predictions of catastrophic events caused by man-made global warming have not come true. The silent spring that we were warned about a number of years ago has not been so silent after all. I was sitting on my porch the other night listening to the whippoorwill going back and forth. It was very noisy at nighttime out there in the late spring here. A couple of these other dire predictions, you know, like the polar ice caps being gone and the water levels rising and engulfing entire cities and so forth, all of these things have not come true at all, and yet that doesn't seem to be brought into the equation at all.
No, it doesn't. And I think what we see there over a long period of time, I mean, this is well over 50 years record now that the environmental movement has of predicting great disasters, and then they turn out never to come about, or not even a faint shadow of them comes about. I think what we tend to see here is, well, frankly, people grasping about for rationales to justify their commitment to very heavy government intervention in people's lives. I mean, fundamentally, these people are statists who want to use the power of the state to control other people's lives. And so they will come up with various different catastrophic scenarios for the near future in order to scare people into giving over control of their lives. You know, frankly, most people of a more conservative bent don't really care to run other people's lives, let people be free, and they just want to be free themselves. So they have a tendency not to get so involved in those matters. But the problem is that if we don't get involved, if we don't expose the falsehoods being propagated by the green movement, then more and more people think, oh yeah, we do need to give over control to our governments. And so little by little, liberty gets eroded, and with it, property rights and the like. And what we've seen historically is that large degree of government control of our economic life, of our business, our trade, and so on, just simply is not good for people. It doesn't lift people out of poverty. It has a tendency to push them back into poverty if they've been out of poverty. And it certainly restricts their civil liberties as well as their religious liberties.
To me, maybe to put this on in a framework that people could easily understand, it's kind of like an HOA, homeowners association, on a grand scale. You know, they give you all these dire warnings that somebody's going to move into the neighborhood and paint their house magenta, and or you're going to have cars up on blocks, and then your property value is going to go down. And then they want you to pay this money to them, and then they want all this control. And the next thing you know, you've got people coming through your yard measuring whether your bushes are the right height and telling you what you can and can't keep in your carport. I mean, it's just crazy. Yeah. You can tell I've got a little bitter about HOAs.
And I happen to live in an HOA myself, and sometimes the intrusions are rather silly and far-fetched. And yet there is a big difference. In the case of an HOA, your living in there is pretty well voluntary, and it's quite easy to decide, we're going to move out, or we're not going to move into the HOA in the first place. HOAs do not have coercive power over us, but governments do. Civil governments have coercive power. It's certainly less convenient to move out of the United States into some other country than it is to move out of Pembroke Falls into some neighborhood that is not part of an HOA. This is a very important difference, because what we're dealing with here is the ability of people to use the coercive power of the state to force other people to do what they want them to do, instead of allowing people to be free within the limits of God's moral law. And what really winds up happening here is that we get a sort of a new religious legalism of environmentalism, replacing God's law as the standard of human behavior. That's a problem that we have noted repeatedly, even in many evangelical environmental writings, is that various environmental desiderata, whether recycling or the use of locally grown food or whatever, these environmental desiderata become moral obligations, and suddenly we're calling sin what God doesn't call sin, and that means really that we're substituting the traditions of men for the commandments of God, which Christ clearly said is wrong.
One of the elements of the radical environmentalism as well is that they have such a poor view of mankind himself. They portray themselves differently as being very caring about individuals and very caring in that way. But the entire open letter to the Pope is making the point that this is going to hurt people in poverty. And one of the underlying tenets of the climate change movement today is this. And you note this in the letter. This is one of the paragraphs says, today many prominent voices call humanity a scourge on our planet, saying that man is the problem, not the solution. Such attitudes often contaminate their assessment of man's effects on nature, naively claiming, quote, the science is settled, unquote. They demand urgent action to protect the planet from catastrophic human-induced global warming, attributing allegedly unnatural warming to the use of fossil fuels and to obtain energy essential for human flourishing. These voices demand that the people surrender their God-given dominion, even if doing so means remaining or returning to poverty. Well, I think that that's well said. They have such a, not only a low view of God, but a low view of man made in God's image. And they basically are saying, you need to give up your God-given right to dominion over the earth, right?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, one author I know of, Alex Epstein, in a book called The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels, points out that most of the environmental movement has as its fundamental value that mankind should have as little impact on the earth as possible. That really contrasts with a biblical fundamental value, which is that human life is sacred. It is exceptional. Human beings alone bear the image of God, and human thriving is the best measure of environmental quality. Human population and human longevity, that is, long life expectancy, those things tell us that we have a good environment. Where people are dying young, where they're dying more rapidly than they're being replaced new births, that's indication of a poor environment. And we need to really be biblical in our approach to environmental ethics, rather than a geocentric, an earth-centric environmental ethic. We need an anthropocentric environmental ethic. And some people will protest, well, you don't want to be man-centered, you want to be God-centered. Well, the truth is that if we are God-centered, we will then, by implication, also be man-centered, because man is the image of God. He is God's representative on earth. And so, whereas we would reject an anthropocentrism that raises man above the level of God or even to the level of God, what I talk in terms of is concentric circles. God at the very center, man just outside of God, but certainly more center than other life forms, and then various life forms, and outside that, non-living matter. But we definitely want to make sure that we recognize the exceptional place of mankind in creation, and the fact that God has called us to exercise dominion over the earth, and that it is possible, especially as the gospel spreads, as more and more people are reconciled to God, as we take captive every thought to the obedience of Christ, it is possible for us actually to improve the natural world through our own efforts. And we see that, for instance, in the enormous increase in crop yields around the world as people learn better and better farming methods. We see it in increasing human life expectancy. Before the Industrial Revolution, average human life expectancy at birth was about 27 or 28 years. Now, in developed countries, it's near 80, and in developing countries, it's around 65 to 70. I mean, that's a tremendous improvement, and it came about by human ingenuity using the minds God gave us, reflecting his own image.
I imagine, and this is probably a broadcast in and of itself, but a good example of that may be what's taking place in California with the water situation. Here we see that from some of the reading I've been doing, it appears that the minnow received more protection than man does.
Yeah.
All this aqueducts and so forth, they could have prevented the problem that they're having now, but because of their policies and because of their ideology, they actually have exacerbated the problem, and in an effort to try to save a minnow rather than help the flourishing of man. Is that a fair perspective?
Yeah, that's a fair perspective, and really the situation in California is even more complicated than that. The simple fact that farmers pay only a small fraction of the total cost of getting water to their farms means that they don't economize on that water as much as they might otherwise do. So, for instance, if you were to, since agricultural use uses about 85% of the water consumed in California, if you would even raise the cost of water to the farms by 10%, that would make more than 50% more water available for residential, commercial, and industrial use. So there are problems there of government, by subsidizing agricultural water use, actually contributing to the shortage. And then, of course, there was a problem that repeatedly proposals for new reservoir construction over the last 50 years or so were turned down, and therefore we didn't corral water in good times to have backup for low precipitation periods or drought periods. That hurts. The fact that the EPA, the federal EPA, and the California Water Resources Board teamed up to require literally trillions of gallons of water to be allowed to flow out into the ocean before being used on agricultural fields in order to preserve the Delta smelt, I mean, that added to the problem, too. So there are all sorts of different problems there, and a more man-centered, man-focused, human well-being-focused policy would have led to less trouble in this period of drought. The actual reduction in rainfall compared with normal is not all that unusual. The fact that there are all these government policies that have distorted the use of the water that does fall, That's what's unusual, and that's what's really to blame for the problems out there.
Mm. Well, Dr. Beisner, we certainly appreciate the work that you folks are doing there at the Cornwall Alliance. Excellent work. This was a great letter that you put together. It really spells out the issues. If you want to help the poor, basically saying to the Pope, then change your idea about climate change, because you're actually going to exasperate the problem. Great work that you've done there. Give us that website once again. I've got the CornwallAlliance.org website, but what was the other one specifically about this letter?
To go directly to the letter, go to climateletter2popefrancis.org. That's climateletter2popefrancis.org. When folks go there, they'll be able to see very quickly the 142 initial signers, including many really outstanding scientists and economists and theologians. And then they'll also have an opportunity to add their own endorsements. Hundreds of people have already done that, and we're welcoming hundreds more, hoping for thousands more to do exactly that. So climateletter2popefrancis.org is the quick way to get there.
Mm. Well, thank you so much again. I've added my name to the list and signed that letter as well. So thank you. I hope I'll encourage my listeners to do it. But thank you so much for visiting with us for a few moments today to talk about such an important issue.
You're welcome, and thank you very much, Kevin. God bless your work.
Okay, thank you. Again, that was Dr. E. Calvin Beisner. He's the national spokesperson for the Cornwall Alliance. Their website is www.cornwallalliance.org, cornwallalliance.org. You can go out there to find out all kinds of great information about the Cornwall Alliance. This is a great evangelical solution to the issue of the climate and the environment, you know, from a Christian perspective. I think it's really well done. Great science associated with it as well. Many scientists are on their board and so forth. Just a great group of people doing great work and very necessary in our day and age. Remember this, Jesus said, you shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free. We'll see you next time.